In days of old, there were some Christians who covenanted together to read the Bible and to pray. They were called covenanters. One was John Brown. He had a wife named Isabel, and they had a lovely daughter. He was hunted and tracked down by the soldiers, brought out with his wife and baby to be shot. He asked to pray. Then he stood up fearlessly. The soldiers lined up to shoot him. They looked at him. Then they looked at his wife with a baby in her arms, and they couldn't kill him. But the leader cursed him. Then he took out his pistol and shot John Brown in the head, killing him. When John fell in his own blood, the leader asked his wife, "What do you think of your husband now?" "Sir," she said, "I thought much good of him in life, but I think much more of him in death." "They are worthy," said our Lord. In Revelation 3, verse 5, our Lord said, "He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." Does this mean that some names may be blotted out? Oh, no! Never forget this principle of interpretation. No obscure passage should ever be quoted in contradiction to a clear line of scriptural teaching for which there are plain statements and great masses of teaching. But how does one have his name written in the book of life? Listen to the words of our Lord. "Whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven. But whosoever shall deny me before men, him will I also deny before my Father which is in heaven." Matthew 10:32-33. Confess Christ on earth, my friend, and he'll confess you in heaven. Now, listen to the appeal. It's found in verse 2. "Be watchful." These people at Sardis knew the importance of watching. When King Cyrus of Persia came to capture Sardis, which was situated on a mountain, on a ridge of rock like a pier, he was stopped. So he sent a message to his men saying, "I'll give a special reward for any man who'd work out a method whereby the unscalable cliff could be scaled and the fortress taken." One day, one of his faithful men saw a soldier of Sardis drop his helmet down into the cliff. He kept his eyes on him and noticed that he picked his way down the cliffs and recovered his helmet. He marked the way he had taken in his mind, and that night he led a picked band of troops up the cliffs that way, and when they reached the top, they found the fort completely unguarded. The garrison never dreamed that anyone could find a way up the cliffs, so they were safe. But when his soldiers entered with his troops and found that they were unopposed, they captured Sardis. The strange thing is that the very same thing happened 200 years later. So when the church at Sardis heard the word of the Lord, "Watch," they realized how important it was to watch. Our Lord added in verse 2, "Strengthen the things which remain." Going to church is good. They weren't to stop going. They were to get right with God. Worship is good. They weren't to stop worshiping. They were to worship in spirit and truth. Giving is good. They weren't to stop giving. They were first to give their own selves to the Lord. Praying is good. They weren't to stop praying. But if they regarded iniquity in their hearts, the Lord wouldn't hear them. Faith is good, but it has no virtue unless it connects us to God. Two men got into a coach as a train was being made up. They sat down and started talking. The porter said, "Move into the coach ahead of this one." "Why?" they demanded. "What's wrong with this coach?" "Nothing," he grinned, "only it's not connected to anything, and it won't take you anywhere." Your faith, to do you any good, to take you to heaven, must be connected to Christ. Is it? Our Lord added in verse 3, "If thou shalt not watch, I will come on thee as a thief, and thou shalt not know what hour I will come upon thee." Our Lord doesn't come upon his bride as a thief, nor upon the unsaved as a bridegroom. The Christians are comforted, but what of the unsaved? They're unnerved. How does the Lord's return affect you? Now, let's study the letter our Lord wrote to the Church of Philadelphia. It's found in Revelation 3, 7-13. It contains no complaint. Does this mean it was perfect? No. There never has been, and there never will be a perfect church. If I were to find a perfect church, and if I were to join it, I'd make it imperfect. But the church is made up of imperfect people. And if it weren't for our perfect head, our Lord, there'd be no church. Look at the area. About 28 miles southeast of Sardis lay the city of Philadelphia. It was founded by one whose name was Philadelphus, so it was named after him. It was called the City of Brotherly Love. The site is interesting. It was the gateway to the east. It commanded one of the greatest highways in the world, the highway which led from Europe to the east. It was the gateway from one continent to another. It was of great significance. This city was built here for one purpose, a missionary purpose, for the spreading of the gospel? No, the spreading of Greek culture. Beyond Philadelphia lay barbarous tribes, wild and wicked. It was planned that from Philadelphia, the Greek missionaries would go to teach the Greek language and the Greek way of life. Now, look at the assembly. Philadelphia was the last bastion of Christianity when it was overrun by the Turks. This church is the church of the closing era. It's the church of the evangelists, the missionaries, the soul winners. It's the church of the worldwide preaching of the gospel of the Son of God. Now, look at the author. Verse 7 says, "Unto the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, These things saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth, and no man shutteth, and no man openeth." First, he says that he's holy and true. This means that God is right in his character and right in his conduct. When character's right, conduct's right. You might as well expect to find a straight line with a crook in it or a cake of ice with fire in it as to find any sin in Jesus. Our Lord's description of himself continues with the verse, "He that hath the key of David." David was a great king of Israel, but Christ was greater than David. Christ is the greatest. But here's the story behind this verse. You can read it in Isaiah 22. Shebna was a crooked politician who feathered his own nest. God threw him out and installed Eliakim in his place and said, "The key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder, so he shall open and none shall shut." No one could gain admission to the royal palace and the royal presence except through Eliakim. Now, Jesus is the steward of God. He's the only one who can introduce us to the presence, the power, and the plenty of God. Jesus said, "No man cometh unto the Father but by me." Jesus is the keeper of the keys. He has the keys to heaven and hope, the keys to the storehouse of divine truth and the divine treasury, the keys to all conditions and circumstances. He also has the keys of hell and death. It's true that our Lord said to Peter, "I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven." And Peter used these keys. How? Through his preaching. When? On the day of Pentecost, when he witnessed to Cornelius. But he's dead. He's in heaven, and the keys are now in the hands of Christ. No person, no people can assure you of an entrance into heaven. No one can keep you from entering heaven. Jesus says, "I am the way." Our Lord continues, "I have set before you an open door." The door he opened remains open today, and that door is Christ. He says, "I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved." Man should enter that door while it's open. When Noah and his family were safely in the ark, the Lord shut the door. The door sealed their deliverance on the inside and sealed the doom of the unsaved on the outside. Today, I'm on the inside. My friend, on which side are you? Don't you want to be on the inside? Then now, right now, come to Jesus, won't you?